Good evening.
Good evening.
I'd ask if you would go ahead and turn in your Bible, 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2, and if you have one, there's an outline in the bulletin. You're welcome to get one. Yours out, or there's some bulletins still in the back with outlines in them, I presume, unless someone stole them out of the bulletins, which is something that I would find amusing, but not terribly helpful. 2 Timothy chapter 3. Chapter 2, starting in verse 3, we're going to go ahead and read the passage. It says here in verse 3, "You therefore must endure hardships as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who enlisted him as a soldier. And also if anyone competes in athletics, he is not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. The hard-working farmer must be first to partake of the crops. Consider what I say," he says there, "and may the Lord give you understanding in all things." Verse 7 is especially interesting because he's talking about a culmination of the things that he's communicating. He's trying to get across. And it's almost like, what do a soldier, an athlete, a farmer, and a Christian have in common? And I know it sounds like the beginning of a joke, but it's not a joke. It sounds like they should all walk into the church building and something weird should happen because they're all there at the same time. Paul makes this comparison to help Timothy understand his purpose and his mission. That's what he's saying there in verse 7. Consider what I'm saying. Understand these connections that I'm making because they're going to help you understand all things. They're going to help you understand that your mission, your goal, your challenges, and the things that are coming your way. The depth of dedication that's required by these kinds of situations are going to help you understand. And so it is a comparison which we need to understand in order to fulfill our obligations, our role as Christians, our ministry in every capacity that we find ourselves. It's tempting to devalue the work, the time, the talents of others. It's a very common thing. I worked with a guy at 80-20, and he would get really upset if anyone was derogatory, mean-spirited towards football players. He was a Lions fan, so I can understand his predicament. But he would get really upset. You know, somebody would call the Lions a bunch of scrubs or some mean thing. It wasn't very nice that they did so. And he would get upset, not just because they were his team, but because they were professional athletes. And he would argue, well, you go out there and do better, because that's not going to happen, you know. And we say ridiculous things. I've said it before to some of the basketball players or whatnot. And, you know, my grandmother could dunk on that person, or my grandmother could, you know, fill the lane better than you're doing, or make that tackle. And I'm not positive my grandma couldn't actually make a few of those tackles. But regardless, we don't value the work, the time, the talents that other people have oftentimes to our own detriment and to the detriment of others. And you see it like at the Flat Rock Festival. I don't know how much experience you guys have in handcrafted materials. I know a few of you absolutely do because you make them. But we see some expensive handcrafted item and wonder why it's so expensive. I was talking to a ceramic vendor at the Flat Rock Festival. In fact, my mother owned a ceramic shop. And so I'm fairly familiar with how ceramics works. And I have always wondered how other people price, you've probably seen them and maybe some of you own them, but very large Christmas trees with the lights on the inside and the bulbs on the outside. And usually it's frosted with some snow-looking material. And I have watched my mother make those in the past. And every time someone comes in and really wants one, they are flabbergasted at the price. And I just walked in and I asked the guy how much for the giant Christmas tree. It's got to be like 16 inches, maybe 2 feet tall. And I was expecting somewhere between $100 and $200 because that's how much they need to be priced in order to make money off of the whole expenditure. And when he told me, I can't remember if he said $150 or $200, he was surprised that I didn't bat an eye, that I didn't gasp in awe because I know how those things are. But you always have someone thinking it's ridiculous that they're making money hand over fist in a venture like that. And I can tell you firsthand that they're not. This is not a situation where they're made in some foreign sweatshop, where it's filled with lead-based paints and could very well kill you if you consumed it in large quantities. I don't know why you would, but if you tried to eat the Christmas tree, it'd probably kill you. You know, that's probably that true anyway, but even touching it sometimes, some of those, you know, things made in foreign countries, they're not well made. And my mom is classic. She would walk into a store that sells knockoffs from other countries, and she picks it up and she turns it over. That's how you can tell if it's a good quality product, if the bottom is painted. Because most don't bother with the time in painting it. They don't know why you ever would, because it never gets picked up. But that's how you tell if it's a quality product, a quality ceramic product anyway, is the bottom painted. And I'm sure with woodworking, I'm sure with other things, there are telltale signs of whether it's made well. And I think our consumer mentality and the opportunity in the community in America at large for cheap products that resemble good quality items, I think that has spoiled us to what it really costs to produce something well, to produce something of good quality. And oftentimes you have people, I'm sure, talking to this gentleman who owned this ceramic shop, and they probably do get very irate, perhaps even, because they really want this Christmas tree, but they're not willing to shell out the $150 to $200 to buy it. And I understand that as well. $250 or $200 is a lot of money. I saw a sign in a woodworker shop one time that said simply, good, quick, or cheap, pick two. Good, quick, or cheap, pick two. And when asked to explain his sign, he would say, you can have it cheap and quick, but it won't be good. You can have it cheap and good, but it won't be quick. Or you can have it good and quick, but it won't be cheap. You can't have all three of them in any circumstance. And it's the same way if you're going to do it yourself. And that's what very few people realize. That they're making a sacrifice in one form or another. And there's a lot of people I've met that have said, oh, well, I just do it myself. Count your time. Figure out how much your time is worth, and figure out how much that inevitably costs you to make yourself. Sometimes it's worth it. Sometimes it's something that you can do. Sometimes you have the talent to do so. But more often than not, what I have found is when I try to do it myself, I end up buying it and have already wasted the product that I tried to build it or make it or whatever the case might be. If I really wanted it, sometimes it just makes sense to purchase it. But we don't oftentimes make the commitment. And because of our culture and the situation we live in and the privilege, let's be frank, that we experience here in America and having access to these kinds of things, we don't value the time invested in certain things. And I think it bleeds into the church. We think that we could do just as well as other people with less effort, with less time, with less commitment, as if to say that those things, they don't matter. There's a reason that you don't have very many multi-sport athletes, professional athletes. It's happened a few times. And usually ones, obviously, that their seasons don't overlap or overlap in very minuscule ways. But it doesn't happen very often because of the time and investment it takes to be good at anything. To be truly great at anything and to be on a professional level requires a level of commitment that we as human beings are rarely willing to give. And we talk about, well, I could go out there and do better. Give me a break. There's no way. There's no way I'm going to go on a baseball field or a football field or the basketball court and do better than any professional or semi-professional or pickup game that I would find at the Y. There's very little chance that's going to happen. But we overvalue our own abilities in a lot of ways. And I think oftentimes we do it in the church. We look at people who are incredible speakers. We look at people who have spent their lifetime in the Word and dedicated to it. And we say, well, why can't I be like that? Why can't I have the knowledge? And in my case, I look up to James Meadows. You know, I've talked about it before. He spent over 50 years, 60, I think, at the time that I left preaching school. He had spent 60 years studying God's Word as a minister, as a preacher, and learning what people were like and how to deal with folks and how to best relate the gospel to the world. And it shows in how he preaches and the things that he does and how he studies and what he knows. And I can't expect at 32 even to be on the level that James Meadows is. But I cannot expect at 75 to be on the level James Meadows was if I don't commit the next 40 years to getting there. It doesn't happen that way. It's not an immediate response, and we expect it to be. We expect to sit down with our Bible and almost like John or Ezekiel. You just got to eat it, right? And we'll just rip a page out if only it were that easy. I rip a page out and I eat one every day, and wouldn't that be great? A great way of learning the Bible? That would be amazing. That's not how it works, though. You've got to put the time and effort, the commitment into it. And it's a delayed reward. What do these four groups of people have in common? A soldier, an athlete, a farmer, a Christian? Well, most explicitly here in verse 6, he says, success doesn't happen immediately. The hardworking farmer must be first to partake of the crops. And that's an interesting, and every commentary that I read, it struggles, they admit freely, that they struggle translating this out of the Greek. In part because of some cultural references that are being made here. But even if we take it simply at face value of what it is literally saying, why would the farmer need to be the first to partake of the crops? And this is going to lead into a future point, but you think about what the farmer has to do, the sacrifice that a farmer has to make. They have to give up some of their previous year's crops. Now, we live in a community, in a world where oftentimes you can buy the seed in order to go sow it, right? I don't know if any of you do. You guys can actually harvest the seeds out of your tomatoes. I mean, most people don't traditionally like to eat them anyway. But you could literally pull them, you could dry them, you could do everything that's necessary, and then you'd have them for the future if you buy the right type of tomatoes. Some tomatoes are genetically grown to not have fruit-bearing seeds, but some of them aren't. And you could do that, and that's what was done in the past. We don't have a problem going to a store and buying the seeds, and oftentimes farmers even do that because they have better quality seeds in their minds, or it gives a better yield, whatever the case might be. There's a lot of reasons it could be done. But in this time period that you're talking about, these Christians that Paul is talking to Timothy, you would keep back a portion of what you reaped the previous year, and you couldn't eat that because it needed to be used to plant the next year's food. And if you do that, then you're running low on food. Why does the farmer need to be the first to partake? Because they have already sacrificed to put that food at all into the field. That they have had to make decisions and they've had to wait for so long. The scriptures regularly reference waiting on the early and the latter rain. And the same is true for us as Christians, in that same way that farmers must wait, in the same way that soldiers, wars are not quick events, especially in their time period. I mean, we're getting to the point where with nuclear weapons and the ridiculous armaments that are taking place now, and we're concerned that if a nuclear war takes place, I don't think it's going to last very long. I mean, not if people are shooting ballistic missiles at each other. That's not going to take long to destroy basically life on Earth, if that were the case. But the problem is that we're not dealing with the 21st century. Wars were not quick events. They took time. And if you're going to spend your time in a military expenditure or a military experience, it's going to be a long process of traveling, mostly footwork, getting from place to place. It takes a long time being a soldier. And the same goes for an athlete, the amount of commitment that's taken. The same goes for, in this case, a Christian. In Galatians chapter 6, in Galatians chapter 6 and verse 9, and these are things that Paul wants Timothy to remember, to keep in mind. And I can't imagine what it would be like to be Timothy in the situation where he has followed Paul around, where he has experienced Paul in the flesh. And I know we sometimes aggrandize Paul. I think he was a pretty great guy. And the level of commitment that man had to the truth, as well as his conviction in preaching the gospel, it must have been a pretty remarkable event. And I've met people who I well respected. And Timothy is in a similar situation. He says, it's not going to happen immediately. Here, Paul is writing to the Galatians. In Galatians chapter 6, notice in verse 9, he says, and let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap, if we do not lose heart. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. Your life will last as long as it lasts. And I know that sounds really ridiculous. I listen to a radio program in the morning sometimes, Mike and Mike. It's a sports show. And Mike Greenberg is a journalist. And he looks like what you would think of when you think of a journalist. He's a smaller man. He's not terribly strong or quick. And Mike Golic was a former NFL player, a former defensive lineman. And they joke regularly about if we were to get into a fight, it would last as long as the NFL player decided that it was going to last. Because if he wanted to end the fight, he could, certainly at just about any moment. And that's the case with our lives. It could end at any moment. It could be very quick or it could be very long. We could end up with 100 years on the earth, or we could end up with a few more minutes. But whatever the case is, Paul argues that it is right and good to patiently continue. To continue doing good if you have opportunity to do good. To continue doing the will of God whenever you have opportunity to accomplish it. He says, we need to recognize that while we are here, we need to be workers in the kingdom. That we need to be committed to it because it could be a long time and it may require lots of patience. I mean, there are different types of seeds as well. If anybody has planted a garden, lettuce doesn't take long to grow. Usually I think it's a few weeks, a little less than a few weeks sometimes for some brands. 10 days and you have lettuce. But you plant some things and it's the entire season. And you have to wait for the early rains and you need the latter rains to come when it's time. And it is an ordeal of patience because success doesn't happen immediately. That good things don't always happen right when you want them to. Sometimes you must be patient. Philippians chapter 1, notice in verse 20. Philippians chapter 1 and verse 20, he says, according to my earnest expectation and hope that in nothing I shall be ashamed, but with all boldness as always, so now also Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. Paul says, I don't know if I have another minute or I have another 20 years on the earth. I don't know how long I'm going to be here, but whatever time I have, Christ will be magnified in it. He says, but if I, verse 21, for to me to live is Christ and to die is gain. But if I live on in the flesh, this will mean fruit from my labor. Yet what I shall choose, I cannot tell, for I am hard pressed between the two, having a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. Nevertheless, to remain in the flesh is more needful for you. And being confident in this, I know that I shall remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy of faith. Now, Paul is not arguing it. He is debating this concept in his mind, but it's in theory because there's one thing that he has left out, and that's that he doesn't control when his life ends. Now, he could, but that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about whether his life is going to end. He's in a situation when he's writing the book of Philippians where he is imprisoned, and again, as he has been in the past, not sure if he's going to survive the ordeal. And he knows whatever happens, he's going to serve Christ. He's going to be committed to him because that's the only solution to the problem of sin, of life in general. The only success that you find is by faithfully continuing in your service to Christ. And Paul is going to argue that until he is blue in the face, until he is in the grave. He is going to argue for being patient with God, being patient with your relationship with him, working diligently towards the end goal, because you never get to the end if you give up in the middle. And that's what so many individuals have done. He's going to talk about a few people through his letters whose faith is shipwrecked because they have given up on their relationship with God, because it got hard or tough, because things didn't go their way. And that's not how you be successful. That's not how you develop a successful business or a successful talent. That's not how you do well in wars either. You don't just give up in the middle simply because it looks like things have turned against you. You keep going and you keep fighting. He's going to go on to the next topic. The next way these four individuals are similar, the athlete, the farmer, the soldier, and the Christian, is that none of these jobs are easy. Verses 5 and 6, he says, if anyone competes in athletics, he is not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. And then he begins verse 6 as well, the hardworking farmer. And that's something that some Christians have struggled with as well. Some people who'd like to be Christians, they're not ready for the commitment of the difficulty of the work. That there is something required of us as Christians, and there is an obligation, a responsibility for us to be faithful to him according to the rules. And in the United States especially, I'm sure other countries struggle with it, but we do not like rules. We struggle with rules. Usually we struggle against rules because we don't like being constrained and fought. We were talking this morning in Bible study about the differences in the perspective of communities in in Africa and some of these third world countries, especially where leadership is terrible, you know, where the community or the governmental leadership is awful and people are suffering because of it. And you bring them the gospel, they don't have much hope at all in this world, and yet they see the gospel and they grasp to it because it is something better than what they have now. And Americans have such a hard time, I've noticed, dealing with that kind of thing. And when we talk about the Bible or even the Old Testament, people perceive it to be a restriction. a restraint in a bad way. And yet, we as parents, if you've ever been a parent, you understand that keeping your child from doing themselves harm or doing harm to other people is a really important job. And yet, when God does it to us, we get really upset. We're acting like children in most cases. But in other places, the keeping people from doing certain things is seen as a benefit, is seen as compassion, is seen as a nice thing. And we looked at Jonah. And Jonah's response from the Old Testament, his understanding of the Old Testament, is that God, even to the Gentiles, was going to be generous and nice and forgiving if they repented. And Jonah was concerned about that. That's why he didn't want to preach anything to the Ninevites, even though all he was going to preach was that you're going to be destroyed in a certain number of days, 40, I believe, if they, period, not if they repented. And we keep making that point. He doesn't offer repentance as an option. But he knew from the character of God that God would be forgiving and merciful if they repented, even to these Gentiles. And that tells me that they have a different perspective. Even Jonah, who hated these Gentiles, that they have a different perspective about the will of God and the Old Testament than we do. I mean, if we lived under the Old Testament, we would constantly be complaining about everything that we're not allowed to do, all these rules. I can't believe it. And yet they saw it as a benefit, as an advantage, as a privilege to serve God. And I wonder sometimes why it's the case, in part because we think Christianity should be easy, because we think everything should be easy. When we look at what other people do, I marvel. I mean, looking at this pulpit, I assume that Brother Vern was a part of the building of this, or some individuals who, no? My goodness, I'm surprised seeing some of the things that he built. But looking at this, looking at the table, looking at a lot of the things around, even things that I know for certain he built because I was told that he did. But I look at this, and it's incredible. You guys might look at it, and I don't know if you appreciate it or not. I hope you do. But it's a very nice piece of furniture. It's a very nice product, the pulpit here. And the workmanship and the craftsmanship that went into it and to many other items that we have here, we're very blessed. And I don't think we always appreciate it. We think that, oh yeah, I could knock that. Oh, I could make that. Yeah, are you kidding me? I couldn't make this. There'd be no way. It would take me years to even try to master some of the nuances of how to do these things. And the more I learn what I've discovered, the more I've learned that I don't know. And if you think about it as like a circle, right? And I know I'm getting math here, so just calm down. It's just a little bit of math. But if you think about a circle, as the perimeter gets bigger, as the circle gets bigger, so does the perimeter. And so do the things that touch that you don't know, right? And the more I learn, the more I don't know, or the more I learn that I don't know. Because the circle has gotten bigger, and the perimeter that it touches, all the things that I don't know, I go, oh, there's things out there that I don't know. And every time I learn something new, I learn all the other things that I don't know. And it just gets kind of, it can be daunting at times, sure. But it's a challenge. It's an opportunity to learn. And people ask me that about the Bible, as if I would get bored of the Bible. Not only is it the most important book that's ever been written, and more important by, I can't even quantify it. Now, let's not get into math again. But I can't even put a number on how much more important it is than anything else. But every time I read it, every time I learn something new, every time I grow in some aspect of it, my knowledge of what I don't know now suddenly gets a little bit bigger. And what I don't know gets a little bit bigger. And so it's a continual challenge, an opportunity. We have to notice that it wasn't intended to be easy. It wasn't intended to be simple. It's tempting to think the work of others is simple or easy, to look at it and go, hey, I could do that. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 58, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, in verse 58, he says, therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. There's two words I want you to pick up, work and labor. And I don't think Paul chose that just haphazardly. I don't think Paul went, yeah, all the words that I could use, sure. I'm going to pick work and labor because they sound nice. I think he meant work and labor. I think he intrinsically meant this is designed to be a challenge, a difficulty, something that we challenge ourselves with and something we work at. work of the Lord is not called the leisure of the Lord. Well, it's a challenge. When you describe Christianity in the Bible, it's described, we're described as a servant. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 24. We're described as pilgrims. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 11. Obviously, again, we're described as an athlete, a farmer, a soldier, all things that are not easy. I don't know one time that a Christian is described or Christianity is described as something simple or easy. Now, the yoke that we're given, we exchange ours for Jesus's. And while you might argue, as Jesus does, that the yoke is easy, I think he means it comparatively to ours. How does anyone get to heaven without Christ? There's no way. That yoke is over our ability to carry. And what Jesus does is exchanges that yoke of our attempt to get to heaven on our own with his yoke of getting to heaven with him. And that is something we can carry. Does that mean it's easy or simple to carry? That it doesn't require sacrifice or commitment? That it doesn't require us to be responsible Christians? No. It, in fact, requires a lot. But we also must realize that difficulty is relative. It's going to be hard work, but not everything is going to be as difficult for you as it is for some others. Resisting alcohol is not hard for me. I do not have a problem with that. I have never had a problem with that. Alcohol is no temptation for me. But I do not think that the people who struggle with alcohol are less of an individual. I don't think they're weaker because they do. It's simply the thing that they struggle with, and I have my things that I struggle with, and we both are struggling together, hopefully. And I respect that. I respect the struggles that people go through in every capacity of their life, and I try not to diminish the capacity or the struggle that certain people go through just because they're going through it in the moment. Everybody has their cross to bear. Everybody has their burdens, and it oftentimes is helpful if we share it instead of being embarrassed by it. And so I try not to diminish anyone's struggle, anyone's difficulty as they find it. I try to help them bear it if it's necessary, if it's important for them, and help them put it where it belongs. The third thing that we find here is that all of these aspects, a Christian, a soldier, an athlete, and a farmer, I turned my page over, that's why I don't remember what they are, they all require sacrifice. A soldier requires a sacrifice of comfort and potentially even of their own lives. But we oftentimes diminish the sacrifice that a soldier makes for comfort. And one of the things that's reminded me of that recently is I watch a video of a guy who does wildland fires. And he's going in and he has to carry only what he can literally carry. And so he talks regularly about the things that he has to remove from his pack, the things that can't go. And he's talking about ounces. He's not talking about pounds. He's talking about ounces of weight that he cannot carry because he has to carry it miles and miles every day and to take care of these wildland fires that are going on in California and Montana, which is where he lives. And the sacrifices that he must make in comfort, of leisure, of all kinds of life aspects that we take for granted because we have a house to fill with stuff. And they don't. They carry everything that they have. Soldiers would be the same way. Athletes obviously make sacrifices of their time and energy, not to be compared to a soldier, obviously, but relative anyway. It was easy for me to see the sacrifices of an athlete and a soldier, but I struggled for a long time thinking of a sacrifice that farmers make outside of the obvious of their time and energy until I remembered what makes them a farmer. You can't eat all your crops year by year or you won't have anything to plant. How hard must that have been for some of these families who needed to plant crops so they could eat next year? But sometimes you were hungry and had to ration the portions early on in the season because you didn't have enough to plant. And you had to make that sacrifice, that decision ahead of time. That would be a true sacrifice of epic proportions for anyone. In Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, he says, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Paul says, not just a spiritual sacrifice, but he says, a acceptable and a reasonable service, that it is logical for you to make this choice. And that's the thing that the world doesn't want to deal with. That's the thing that doesn't make sense to a lot of people. Why would you do that? Well, it makes sense because of what you're getting is much greater. If you really ran the numbers, which you can't because we're talking about salvation of your soul and not going to hell and instead going to heaven, and you can't quantify those things. But I think we could all accept that it is much better to go to heaven than it is anything else in the world. And you could lump everything together, every sacrifice you could ever make, even if God required them, would they be worth going to heaven? And I would have to say, yes. Yes, they are. So unequivocally that it's incomparable. And yet people refuse to make that sacrifice. People refuse to go that step further to actually living the life with Christ because they'd have to give some things up. And that's what Hebrews 12 is trying to encourage people to do, to realize and rationalize this in their minds, that giving these things up is not only a benefit, not only necessary, but it's also beneficial. In Hebrews chapter 12, notice in verse 1, he says, "Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." And you would say, well, why would the Hebrews writer say that? Doesn't everybody just want to get rid of sin? Now really, look in your life. Let's be real and frank here. Do we really always just want to give up the sin? Do we really honestly always committed in the way that we should be to removing that sin from our lives? Or are we sometimes tempted to leave that sin for a little bit longer because we're going to deal with some other things first? Or because we can argue and reason with ourselves that we've done a lot of really good things lately? It's not always easy to give up sin, to give up the struggles that we have, to sacrifice the sins and the stumbling block. And we oftentimes say, well, that's just ridiculous. Why wouldn't you give up those stumbling blocks? Well, why didn't the Jews give up the stumbling blocks? Do we think we're any different? No, we're going to struggle with similar things. We're going to do similar things because we're humans. And compared to God, we are really dumb. Really dumb. And when we don't accept Christ's help, when we don't accept the salvation of our souls, we prove that very point, that we as humans, we're not as smart as we think we are. God is much, much, much smarter. Again, order of magnitude smarter, some number that is incalculable to me. So as we come to the conclusion of this particular lesson concerning these things, I want to remind you that Paul is giving this admonition to Timothy, someone who he has trained and helped raise to the point where he has trusted him to go to Ephesus and to work with this congregation in Ephesus, to minister to them and to challenge them and to communicate the will of God to them. And yet he's still sending him information, still sending him encouragement, still sending him the things that Timothy and the congregation there are going to need to continue faithfully in God's will, because that's Paul's ultimate goal. Not just to communicate to them, not just to talk to them, not just to hear back from them, but more importantly than anything, to help them stay faithful. In Matthew 9, in verse 36, he says, "But when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion for them, because they were weary and scattered like sheep having no shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, 'The harvest truly is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore pray the Lord of harvest to send forth laborers into his harvest.'" Will you enter into this labor of soul winning? Will you commit yourself to being an advocate for change, the right type of change in this world, the change towards a spiritual life for those who are listening and for yourself? Perhaps it needs to begin with winning your soul from destruction by putting on Christ in baptism. If we can help you to put your life right with Christ tonight, whatever you need, I pray that you would let it be known as together we stand and sing.